Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, back for another 2 hours with two extraordinary guests on important discussions. In the first hour, my guest is Mickey Z. His name is Michael Zazima, but he goes by Mickey Z. And for those who don't know Mickey, Mickey is an activist. He's an author. He's a writer and contributor to many progressive websites. His books include Saving Private Power, The Hidden History of the So-Called Good War, so-called my words. There was nothing good about any war, good one or otherwise. The Seven Deadly Spins, Exposing the Lies Behind War Propaganda. And Mickey has a new one out titled No Innocent Bystanders, Riding Shotgun in the Land of Denial. Mickey, are we connected together?
Yes, we are. How you doing, Steve?
Oh, Mickey, it's a delight to have you on.
Thanks so much.
I read your Seven Deadly Spins. My goodness, I forget when, 3, 4, 5 years ago. When did it come out?
It came out in 2004.
I read it shortly after it came out, so I guess it was about 4 years ago or so. Oh, that book really struck me. That's how I learned about you in the first place. And I thought at the time, I hope this guy writes more books. Well, you have. You've written No Innocent Bystanders. And indeed, Mickey, I guess what you're talking about, and you give lots of examples in the book, that we need to do a lot more than just moan to our neighbors, complain about how bad things are, how bad George Bush is, forget about everything else going on, maybe participate once in a while in a protest, and then go home and watch the football game. That just doesn't cut it, Mickey. Is that one of the things you're getting at?
Essentially, yeah. I picked this rather provocative title to exactly highlight what you just mentioned. Over the years of writing books and articles, I feel like my perspective has definitely evolved into this direction where I don't think there's any value in pulling any punches and saying that here we are in America, the American people wield an incredible amount of power and influence, and yet, as you say, the majority of what passes for activism is a lot of moaning and groaning and complaining and stopping ourselves from taking a deeper look or taking more serious steps. And, you know, we set up protests on weekends so nobody has to miss a day of work or school, and you agree beforehand with the cops how many people are going to be arrested, and you limit yourself to these so-called free speech zones. If it was all part of a futuristic novel in 1973, people would have thought it was fanciful, but this is what we're living through. It's real. This is what passes for dissent in 2008.
It really is a shame because people in other countries are far more activists than we are. They literally lay it on the line. I've written, it's been quite a while now, and I'm not current on what's going on, Mickey. And we have a break, we have four commercial breaks. We have one coming up in a minute or so. When you hear music, we'll know that we have to cut away. But, I'm sure it was over a year ago now that I wrote about the people in Oaxaca, Mexico. These brave people, they were literally screwed by the state government, and they went out in the streets, and they did more than protest. They just literally set up tents, and they lived there, and they decided they were not going to take it anymore, and they just laid it on the line, and they went up against the state governor and against the repressive forces that came, security forces brought in from other areas, part of the Mexican military. And they may still be protesting, but I mean, people died in that protest.
Oh, yes, yes.
Mickey, let's take a break, and we'll come back and jump back into your book.
Great, thanks.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. The News Hour is part of globalresearch.ca. Michelle Chosudovsky is my co-host. He's the editor of the site, and the site is just a treasure trove of information that people need to know about on the current situation in the world in terms of domestically, or really globally in terms of the terrible financial crisis going on. The wars we never hear anything about anymore. The people that are suffering terribly around the world. And we worry more about who's going to win the big game this weekend, or the latest fashions, or whatever it is that piques our interest. Mickey, I think we have it too soft in this country. So many people around the world really go through a lot of duress and hardship, and when they react the way I wish people in this country reacted. They go out and they fight for something. It doesn't mean that they get it. You don't win many of these battles, but you win none of them unless you're willing to do more than just show up at a protest every now and then or complain to your neighbors.
I absolutely agree. The two interesting points there is that there are examples in American history. You know, there are a few movements in this country that have succeeded: anti-slavery, women's suffrage, civil rights, labor unions. And those folks, yeah, they didn't just go to a weekend parade and dress up as a puppet consider that they did their part. I mean, this was a full-time commitment on their part and at very, very high risk. And in these examples, you saw the results. But as you said, even if the results don't come out the way you want them to, that still doesn't justify not trying. And this country, it's interesting. Americans have just enough creature comforts to keep them pacified, just to keep them at a point where they're not willing to risk losing what they have. It's not, you know, we seemingly have these wonderfully comfortable lives, but all you have to do is kind of peek beneath the facade and you realize that things aren't as good as we like to believe they are. But there's just enough comfort to keep us from stepping out of our own little comfort zone. And it's interesting that sometimes when I give talks and I discuss the American way of life and how Americans make up 5% of the global human population but consume more than 25% of the world's resources, people will sometimes say to me, I feel attacked. I feel like you're attacking me for my lifestyle. And I have to, there's a part of me that just has to shake my head in the use of the word attack. I mean, we don't know what it's like to be, you know, a handful of Americans, sure. There's people who have been brutalized, and the Mumias and the Leonard Peltiers and the people who faced the prison industrial complex. But attack is the people underneath the bombs in Iraq and underneath the bombs in Afghanistan, the bombs that we're paying for and in many cases willingly paying for. And I think our perspective is just so skewed and so, as you say, soft that you wonder, what is it? If it's not 9/11, if it's not the global economic meltdown, what is it that's going to snap people out of this and make them realize that they have to take responsibility and step up and be accountable and try and make a difference?
Oh, Mickey, I agree with that so much. I think the only thing that snaps people out of their slumber is when they really feel severe pain. Back in the 1930s, there were much stronger protests about what was going on than anything since we came out of that period. But people, 25% of the public was unemployed. There was real deprivation in the country, and people didn't have enough money to buy enough food to eat. People were until programs were put in place, people were losing their homes. They put enough pressure on the government, Mickey, that they forced the Roosevelt administration to do what they hadn't planned to do when they came in. Roosevelt campaigned in 1932. If you read his platform, if you read what it was that he claimed he stood for when he ran for the presidency, and you left his name out, you'd have thought that a Republican was running for president on the Democrat ticket, like today.
We
have a one-party state today with two wings. Well, it really was about the same back then. Roosevelt was a patrician, but things were pretty bad, and Herbert Hoover messed things up, but he did try to do something. But we really were in a pickle by the time that 32 election came up, and by the time Roosevelt got in, there was real fear among the people in power, at least a good number of them, including corporate heads, that if they didn't do something, the threat of capitalism was on the line. And the memories, the echoes of the Russian Revolution in 1917 were still very audible. And there were people that were really scared that they literally had to give up a little to save the system. And if they didn't, they might lose everything. And that's where the New Deal came. Because people were more militant then than anything that goes on today, which is really awful. We're in another economic financial situation that potentially may rival what went on in the 1930s. I honestly don't think that's the case, Mickey, but things are at such extreme levels out of control that there's no telling what may happen, so anything is possible. That would create the kind of duress that people lived under in the 1930s, which would get them exercised enough to want to do something about it. One other comment, then you jump back in. You mentioned the times in our history where people did things that were thought to be impossible. Probably the most impossible was ending slavery. I had Frances Fox Piven on my program some months back. I spotted a book that she wrote called Challenging Authority, and she went through four times in her history when people, ordinary people, grassroots, did the impossible. Ended slavery, civil rights, labor movement. These things can be done again. I mean, we literally, we can turn the country if enough of us decide we want to. But if we just sit back and do what we've been doing in our normal course of activities, then nothing will happen. Nothing will change the direction we're going in, and things will only continue to get worse.
I couldn't agree more. I once heard a quote where someone said that every revolution looks impossible until it starts to happen, and then it looks inevitable. And of course, things look very difficult. And of course, as you said, the challenge of doing the impossible is daunting. But if you feel the passion and you feel that you're on the right path, you'll find a way to try to make it happen. And a couple of things that you said. First of all, I certainly appreciate your comments on FDR, because he's one of these historical figures that has been so thoroughly sanitized since his time period that, you know, people really very rarely look at him critically unless they're judging him from the right. You know, then they'll say he was a socialist or whatever, but there's very little criticism of him from the left. So I appreciate that commentary. But I think one of the most important differences between the 1930s and now is the methods of corporate propaganda and the technology by which to purvey these methods. I think back then it was probably easier for individuals to think for themselves and create their own thoughts and passions and ideas of how the world should be, as opposed to the way it is now in the post-television age, right up into the Internet, because the role of the corporate media cannot be understated when looking at the nature of American society, the softness, as you said. It's not a coincidence that this society is so accepting, and this society will line up, you know, will just be so easily tricked and pacified when the stakes are so incredibly high. You know, right now we have an economic situation that, as you say, could reach the point where it's comparable to the 1930s, but we also have now an environmental situation which is infinitely worse than it was then. And to use the word drastic would be an understatement, but yet it doesn't, you know, people, the most they're going to do is maybe switch to recycled toilet paper or energy efficient light bulb, which doesn't mean you shouldn't do those things, but I mean, if you're going to pat yourself on the back and sit back down and watch the game, as you say, needless to say, it's not going to get the job done. And I don't think it's a coincidence. I think that the powers that be saw what the American people are capable of in the 30s and even to some degree in the 60s, and they learned more from these time periods than the people on the street, and they learned ways to pacify, put out the propaganda, and ways to just make sure that we create this illusion of a society open to all opinions, but never really be open to all opinions.
Mickey, the only thing we have now, and over the last 10, 15 years or whatever, we have the Internet. That is our voice. But you're right that the power of corporate propaganda is almost omnipotent, except we have a counterforce. But, of course, the number of people that we can reach online, you write an article, I write an article, it goes up on a bunch of websites. A glorious man, a guest who came on my program, said to me the same thing. You know, if I write an article on an important topic and if I reach a few thousand people and they read it, I'm lucky. But how do you compare that with primetime TV that can reach millions? So they reach an audience of millions, and we reach barely a handful. But this is our tool, and we have to fight back. But the power of their bread and circuses, the dominance of the media, the kind of material they put out over it, it is mind-boggling. Back in the 1930s, as you say, radio was just beginning. It came about early, late 1920s. Commercial radio didn't start until I think the late 1920s. I mentioned it a couple of times in articles. I think it was the late 1920s, but it was nothing. So it was the power of the press back then, emerging radio. I know in 1934, the year I was born, the so-called Radio Act, Roosevelt signed the Radio Act, that really opened up the market for commercialism. We were at a fork in the road whether radio would be mostly commercial or non-commercial or both, and it went down the commercial path because of the act that Roosevelt signed. My goodness, we've got another break that we have to take. Mickey, let's go ahead and take that, and then we'll come right back.
Great, thanks.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Mickey Z. Mickey, just a quick comment, and I'm interested in your thoughts on this, too. We're practically on the eve of another so-called presidential election. I say so-called. Maybe you feel this way, too. Obviously, the last two, 2000, 2004, they weren't just stolen. They were blatantly stolen. 2004 more than 2000. When they flooded the country with these touchtone electronic voting machines where you put in a vote for candidate A and candidate B ends up with two votes. That's the way the system works. Plus all the other schemes they have of purging voter rolls and going through all the things that literally make a farce out of what we call elections. Well, they're not really elections in my mind. It's mere theater. And I'm convinced, Mickey, that Tuesday's outcome was decided way back, and people will go to the polls and they'll vote, but I wonder what difference it makes. I don't think it makes any difference. I think the winner is picked. I'm just not sure who it is, but I have a sense in my gut that it may be Obama, and I try to read between the lines in this morning's Wall Street Journal. About as establishment and pro-business as you can get, especially since it's owned by Rupert Murdoch now. And I just have the feeling that they're talking about, on November 5, the headline being President-elect Obama. I may be wrong, but I just sense they sure don't say it. But in their editorials and in commentary, the front page headline says, I mean, you can even read between the lines in this, Obama leads in home stretch. It sounds to me like they're sort of saying, it looks like we're stuck with him. From a right-wing point of view, I guess they would say, it's not because he's black, that's not the issue.
No.
It's what he's going to do for business that's the issue. I mean, they'll take him black on the top and white on the bottom and maybe yellow in the middle. It's what he's going to do for business. That's the only thing that matters to them.
Yeah.
But I just kind of sense that they're, well, it kind of looks like that's the way it's going to be. And I'm reminded of back in 1976, Mick, the Rockefellers chose Jimmy Carter to be president that year. Gerald Ford simply was window dressing. He went along for the ride. And the reason was because we had those turbulent Nixon years. And business decided that we needed a break, a breather. So they picked Jimmy Carter, who was a trilateralist. The Trilateral Commission founded in 1973. Jimmy Carter, a founding member. These were business people, the Rockefellers and so on. And they were the people that wanted to further the business interest, but maybe do it in a little less turbulent way than the way Nixon was proceeding. So Jimmy Carter was their man, and he simply held down the office for 4 years, until the Republicans took it back, and I think all that was planned as well. And I have a feeling that this possibly, again, I don't know, I could be wrong, but again, this could be a repeat of another 1976 moment. when maybe Obama will kind of cool things down for 4 years, and then the Republicans will take it back in 2012. And making that argument a little stronger for me is the fact that they picked a guy to head the ticket who really is hated by a lot of his own people in the party. And they picked this caricature of a vice presidential candidate. Even the AP, when she was nominated, said about her that she knows more about fishing than affairs of state. And I said, I don't want to make nasty comments, but my comment about her at the beginning was that she's only notable for having been chosen. If it weren't such a serious matter, it's ludicrous to pick someone so supremely unqualified to hold any high office. I can't imagine how she got to be governor. I wouldn't want her sitting on my condominium board, let alone where she is now. Anyway, anything there you want to take?
Yeah, there's a lot of ground to cover there. I'm going to backtrack all the way to the beginning. It's difficult to say with certainty what's fixed and not fixed. And I've learned to not be surprised by anything coming from the U.S. government, unless it was altruism. That would surprise me. But
indeed,
I think to tie it into our discussion earlier with the corporate media and the role of corporate propaganda, what these media outlets ensure is that whoever does win is never going to be too far out of the acceptable business mainstream. It might be a younger face of color, like for example this year, but I mean even the most cursory view of Obama's record shows that Wall Street is going to love him. And it is a little suspicious that the Republicans picked such an unlikable ticket. It's sort of like when Bob Dole and Kemp ran in '96 against Clinton. It was just, when the Democrats put up Dukakis. There's certain times you put that a candidate comes up and you almost say, my goodness, this is a sacrificial lamb. This person doesn't stand a chance. But then again, with voter fraud, with voter purging, with the high level of racism in this country, you never know what's going to happen tomorrow. I genuinely wonder that how many people, white Americans, when they're alone in that booth, will still vote for Obama. This is a country steeped in white supremacy. Who knows? So, but at the end of the day, the business community is going to win whoever wins.
Oh, I agree with you. The black factor definitely will play, and there are white people who simply will not vote for a black candidate.
I agree.
Let's take another break, Mickey, and we'll come back. One more break after this one.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Mickey Z. Mickey, I remember, I'm convinced that the day will come when, as racist as our society is, and also our extreme class society getting worse all the time, but I'm convinced that someday a black man or woman will be elected president, and for sure a woman will be elected. When you think it took until around 1920 before women were even allowed to vote, and it took a constitutional amendment to make that happen. So throughout our whole history until around 1920, it was thought that it wasn't proper for women to vote. I'm old enough to remember back in 1960 when Kennedy, the first Catholic president, I don't know that we would give it a thought that a Catholic would be elected president now. But back then, if my memory serves, I think there were comments if you elect Kennedy, it will be like putting the Pope in the White House.
Yeah, he had to hold a press conference to deny this.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, that would get a lot of people shaken up.
Yeah.
Who am I electing, Jack Kennedy or the Pope? So what are people saying now? It's true that a lot of people will not vote for somebody because of something other than their qualifications. I guess that says something about the human species, Mick, not the condition in the U.S., but the U.S. alone has enough of its own conditions to be very disturbing, which is why you wrote your book.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a situation where I think this election cycle really serves as an excellent microcosm of many of the things that are wrong in this country, and it seems how just to see how willing people are to vote against their own interests, it's pretty frightening. I mean, what a victory for propaganda! I mean, the Goebbels would be drooling at such a victory where you could just simply slap a label on someone like liberal, and it doesn't matter if that person is as right wing as possible. He or she is a liberal, and I definitely think that it's quite possible that Obama will win tomorrow, and if not, as you say, it's inevitable that there will be a person of color that's president, a woman that's a president, and I hardly look at these situations as victories if the type of woman or person of color we're talking about is, say, a Condoleezza Rice. I mean, they're essentially just internalizing the same rich white male corporate values that have been in power since the beginning of America. And I mean, if someone said, "Oh, we're going to have if Cynthia McKinney would win tomorrow, a woman and a person of color," and I'd say, "Wow, okay, that's a little different." You know, this is a step in a completely different or at least a drastically different direction. But I think at some point it just behooves the American powers that be to have more women and people of color in the system, because it just enhances that delusion that America is this diverse, quilt of ethnicities and thoughts and ideas, and we're so open here that we, look how far we've come. And I don't want to downplay the importance of having an African American man elected, because there is some significance to it. But to me, the significance is severely outweighed by the fact that Obama's policies are probably to the right of what Richard Nixon was campaigning on in 1972. It's just that we just keep shifting further and further in that direction. So relatively speaking, he might be to the left of McCain on a few tiny little issues, but they're both drastically to the right of the way you were talking earlier, how Roosevelt might have been saying. And that's the tricky part. I think until people are willing to think for themselves and not be told what to think by the media, it's difficult to imagine them taking the steps that we need them to take. But it's also becoming increasingly difficult for me personally to always use this excuse, well, they just don't know better, or not enough Americans know, or they're being bombarded by this. They're human beings. They have the capabilities of thinking for themselves and recognizing a lie when it's put right into their face. And at some point, it's time to stop making excuses, and it's time to step up. It's time to use your faculties of critical thought and think for yourself and do what needs to be done, as you mentioned earlier, like in the other countries. You know, people look down their noses in America at third world countries, and there's so much we can learn from these societies, not the least of which that when somebody tries to step on you, you stand up for yourself no matter what the risks are. And Mexico is a fine example of that. The Mexicans in America are so terribly demonized. But I tell you what, I'll look at the Mexicans who stood up in Chiapas and say I'll stack them up against any group of Americans I've ever come across in terms of putting their values into action.
Amen.
And we need to stop relying on these excuses and step up now, because the stakes have never been higher.
The stakes keep getting higher and higher, and I have a feeling that what we're going through in our current crisis, Mick, is I'm convinced that the worst is yet to come, and we're papering it over, the so-called rallies that we see on Wall Street. I don't know how many listeners are aware of a couple of groups lurking underneath the covers, so to speak. The Plunge Protection Team, we'll talk about it in the second hour today with my guest who's written about it, along with much, much more. anyone who thinks that financial markets move randomly and are affected by the collective wisdom of those who invest in them, that's one of our many myths in the country. The markets are heavily manipulated, and the plunge protection team is a government effort, the Treasury and the Fed and officials that pump money in and move the market up, down, or whatever way they want it to go. And there's a corporate team that manipulates the market as well. And this is to keep the ship afloat as best they can. So this is stimulating a rally. First, they took it down in October, the biggest crash since back in the 1930s, the worst week Wall Street ever had. It really is astonishing to think that. People think 1929. The 1929 crash, Mick, was in 3 days. I had to go back and take a look at it. It began the previous week on Black Thursday, and then it continued on Monday and on Tuesday. So that, as bad as that Monday and Tuesday were, the week that we had it in October was worse than that 1929
wow.
week. So that doesn't tell you what's coming. Who knows what's coming? But now we have manipulation in the opposite direction to make people think that the storm has passed and everything is fine and we can look forward to better times ahead. Well, I mean, that's just ridiculous. You take a look at the economic data coming out. It's the most abysmal in 30 years. And each new report seems to sound worse than the ones that preceded it. We had one come out this morning that was the worst manufacturing report since 1982. And manufacturing is extremely important to the economy. You see that just go right down the toilet. And I mean, it shakes people who understand what this stuff really means. So we paper it over and we create false ideas and the power of myth-making, whether it's on candidates, whether it's in the economy, in the financial markets, whatever it is. At the same time, Mick, I think this was the point I started to make. I think things just may get bad enough so that no matter who is elected, preferably a Democrat to a Republican, some things like back in the 1930s will have to be done, because if they don't do them, they will fear that there could be some public rumblings they just don't want to face.
Sure.
So they will do enough to stow the problems under the carpet and make people think that something is being done for them, to keep possibly the idea that heaven forbid, a revolution might break out. I mean, if things get bad enough, anything is possible. Well, they don't want that.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't want... as unlikely as it seems, obviously, a situation can go from 0 to 60 much faster than anyone ever imagined, and I think that's part of again, it feeds into our culture in which we're taught to treat as heroes the Warren Buffetts and the Bill Gates and the Donald Trumps, the people who make the most money are heroic figures in our society, and we people who don't have any interest in it at all and have no stake in it at all care on a daily basis whether the Dow Jones Industrial Average goes up or down, as if it has any bearing on our lives, and as you said, as if it isn't being manipulated by powers that we pretend we don't even know about. You know, like the Dow Jones Industrial Average drops and the newspapers scream out stop the press, but I always say if the global infant mortality rate rises, you don't even know if it'll even make the papers. You know, that's our priorities on this planet. We're worried about if the billionaires are going to lose a little bit of money. And I think that again, the people on Wall Street and the government bureaucrats that tend to be in this revolving door where the people who staff the cabinet positions and the high positions in one administration, they're in the cabinet, and then a new person comes in and they're back running their private industries and their brokerage firms, and it's the same people in a revolving door, whether it's in the EPA or whatever department it might be. These people learned a lot from that time period, and they're able to finagle a bailout in which there's so little in it for the people. You know, Ralph Nader just said something the other day, like if there was 0.1% tax on security sales in Wall Street, they would pay this entire bailout off in less than a year.
Oh, absolutely.
And nobody wants to hear that. And of course, they hear the word tax, and you know, the the devil word during this campaign has been socialism. Meanwhile, it's socialism that's keeping capitalism alive for at least the past 70 years or more. I mean, people don't want to hear about that. The propaganda victory is so astonishing that sometimes I have to stand in awe of it, that you could have a system in which these giant transnational corporations exist because their costs are socialized and their profits are privatized. But if someone really wants to smear you, and even in the year 2008, you'd call Obama a socialist because he used the phrase redistribute the wealth, clearly by accident. He has no intention of doing that. He used it by accident, and he's being slapped with the label socialist as if it were an insult, and as if America isn't surviving right till now with this bailout on straight-out government subsidies for the rich. I mean, it's socialism, or maybe you'd call it state capitalism. But, it's just so much easier to pretend that you're going to leave this all to the experts and see who wins American Idol next month. And this is the genius of the system. Just, you know, you said bread and circuses and enough distractions, enough creature comforts, just to keep all these great minds in America, the people who have creativity and passion and courage, to just keep all that stuff down and worry more about, you know, what free agent is going to sign with what baseball team during the off season, then the future of life on this planet. I mean, they've got us, our priorities so screwed up that baseball is more important than our literal land base.
It literally fractures my mind to think about it. It gets me so upset. Way back, I used to follow all of these, with the sports bread and circuses that went on. I would worry if my Red Sox became a loser again and blew it at the end of the year. And I look back at that time now and say to myself, you know, when I was a young boy growing up, that was fun because what did I know? 12 years old or something. And that's what 12-year-old kids should spend their time on. They shouldn't worry about affairs of state. But as you get older, you should realize that this is a lot of nonsense. And your life and your welfare, this is what really is most important. Indeed, we do have socialism for the rich and law of the jungle, free market capitalism for everybody else. But it's worse than that, Mick, because what's going on now, the heart of this financial crisis is the greatest fraud in the history of the country. Back in the 1920s, we had a Teapot Dome scandal, and the Secretary of the Interior, I believe he was, a man named Fall, if I remember the name correctly, haven't thought about that in a long time, he got hung out to dry for being complicit in giving away an oil contract to an oil company, giving away a land rights to drill for oil. I mean, it was like comparing a pickpocket's offense to literally looting the national treasury today, which is what's going on. The national treasury has been and is being looted of trillions of dollars. So the people who committed the fraud, the fraudsters, people that FDR called banksters, a great word, I wish I had thought of it, banksters, that's what they are. They're banksters. They are being rewarded for their crimes with more, not just billions, but the 700 now kicked up to $850 billion. It's going to go into the multi-trillions before this is done, but not a lot is going to be said about it. They're being rewarded for their crimes. Who said crime doesn't pay? And in this country, if you're hungry and you want to feed your family and you steal a few bananas or a couple of loaves of bread, you can get 10 years in prison. But if you loot the national treasury, they give you the key to go back and loot it some more.
Yeah.
Some system.
They'll name you Secretary of the Treasury next.
They'll name you Secretary of the Treasury. Well, the other part of it is, you can almost say that Goldman Sachs, as much as any other firm, is at the heart of all of this chicanery. And they keep recycling their people in and out of the government. Robert Rubin under Bill Clinton. And now we've got Paulson under George Bush. And he brought in another Goldman Sachs guy, I forget his name, to hand out the so-called $700 billion to the people who are going to be getting it. Another Goldman Sachs guy. And this is going to continue, I'm positive, in a new administration.
Rubin is an economic advisor of Obama's.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And he's also got Penny Pritzker on his team. Some people call her the most powerful woman in the country. She probably will not take a public position, but she was one of the inventors of subprime mortgages. And she looted an SNL in suburban Chicago. She defrauded people out of, I don't know how much money, millions of dollars. She walked away scot-free, and she's one of Obama's advisors.
Yeah. I mean, that's an excellent way of looking at what an Obama administration might be like, looking at his economic advisors, looking at his foreign policy advisors like Zbigniew Brzezinski and so on. They're just recycling the same people through, and to expect a different outcome would be insanity. I mean, it's as you said, it's very, very analogous to the Carter years in the sense that you're going to put a softer face, you're going to calm things down. You won't have a cartoon character in the White House like a Nixon or a Bush, but you're going to have somebody that's going to just keep the ship steady for a while until the next person comes in. But the advisors behind the scenes, all the Rasputins, are all the same faces and names. And when a guy like Colin Powell comes out for Obama, somehow people are impressed with that. To me, it was like, well, Obama now has the war criminal vote. You know, like, why are we impressed with that? It's the same people doing the same things over and over.
Oh, right, Nick, we have to take another break. You get Colin Powell and the Fed chairman, Bernanke, endorsing Obama. It's like he's already been anointed to be the next president. Let's take a break, and we'll come back and finish up the hour. It goes by too fast, Nick.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Mickey Z. Mickey, one more reason to worry as we get late in the Bush administration and in a few days, I don't know when it'll be official, but let's say roughly 24 hours or so, we'll have a president-elect. Unless there's a coup d'etat in that remaining time. There's been all kinds of talk about George Bush not wanting to leave office and the possibility of another 9/11. Michelle Chosudovsky wrote an article quoting people suggesting that a recent article that he wrote on this suggesting that people in the media, people in positions where their voice is heard, that we need another 9/11 to marshal the U.S. public behind one thing, and that's to support the government and what the government is doing, and on the full theory that they're protecting the common interest, protecting our interest. So what better way to do it than to have a 9/11 type event, and people are mesmerized by fear, and they get behind the government because who else is around to protect us, to keep us from the bad guys? They don't realize that the bad guys are the people in government. But it's a very scary thought that we would have another one, and we've still got a couple of months left before Bush leaves office, assuming he's leaving, and heaven only knows what they have in mind over that period of time.
It could be one of the classic examples of when they're going to say they averted a major attack, this was going to happen. This many planes were going to be taken down. This many buildings. They tell you all these terrible things that were going to happen. That might even be enough, you know, just to show the stakes are too high to change captains on the ship now. I don't pretend for a second that I know what's going on totally behind closed doors, or I know what's going to happen. But I've learned to not be surprised, as I said, by anything but altruism. The U.S. government and the corporations that own it essentially proven, they have a track record that shows that they will leave no stone unturned to further their power and maintain their power. And you just stand by sometimes and you can't believe that it's not as obvious to everyone as it is to some of the people that I know. It just seems like it's they're just sticking it right in your face, and people would prefer not to deal with it.
Mick, there's no question about that. I want to mention your book again, and I guess it's easy to get by simply going to Amazon. But when did the book come out? It's called No Innocent Bystanders.
Yes.
Riding Shotgun in the Land of Denial. It is out now, right?
Yes, it is.
And it's been easy to get on Amazon. Easy to order on Amazon.
Yeah, or they can go to mickeyz.net, and you'll see a cover image of the book, and you could click right on that, which will take you to the Amazon page if they would rather just go that way. But, yeah, No Innocent Bystanders either on Amazon or through MickeyZ.net.
Well, your style is very, very, it's hot-hitting, it's easy to follow, and it really impacted me when I read your Seven Deadly Sins, and I didn't know who you were, but I read that book, and it just sent a very powerful message to me, and I know in all of your writing, this is what you do, and you make it very easy for people to understand some of the most important things that everybody needs to understand.
Well, thank you very much. That's about as great a compliment as anybody could give me, because that's exactly what I'm aiming for, and coming from you, someone whose work I read all the time, and I just read your article on Studs Terkel, for example, and it's a great compliment, and it's also just a lot of fun and a great honor to be invited on your show and have this chance to chat with you.
Oh, Mick, well, the feeling is mutual. It's a great honor for me to have you on. I'm just an ordinary guy. I don't know who people think. I'm just an ordinary guy. I'm retired.
We need a lot more ordinary guys like you. How's that sound?
Well, we need an
ordinary guy. We need more ordinary guys like
we
you.
We need more ordinary guys getting out there, and we'll shake the world. Mick, that music says that they're going to interrupt with a commercial. Too little time, but again, my very great thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real
thanks,
pleasure.
Thanks, Mick.
Bye-bye.